And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do bleh. Sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Welcome, welcome.
Okay. Good morning.
That's better. So you're listening. This is the Three Left Show. If you didn't get that intro, if it didn't function as a proper introduction, Three Left Show covers news, culture, and anything of interest from a social anarchist perspective, promoting direct democracy and a commons economy. This show is about going in a different direction. So thank you for listening. This is so let's see. Last week, it's been a full week since we recorded a show. And there's been a lot of things happening. Just a quick follow-up on Gaza and Israel. Some details left out that I left out, not accidentally last week, was that when it's said that Hamas organized the protest, they're referring to the fact that Hamas gave their go-ahead, like they wouldn't stop it from happening. The protests have been organized completely independently of them. Or maybe some Hamas members are part of it. Whatever. They are, in fact, the elected government there, whether you like it or not. And the protests themselves are taking kind of a direct action salt march or a kind of protest that in South Africa, I forget what it's called, but it was also kind of a turning point where it was a nonviolent protest and the apartheid government just mowed people down. And so that's kind of happened again. There's been another protest that's going to happen on a weekly basis, a bit smaller for obvious reasons, but 9 people were still killed. And these were more younger guys. And they were burning a lot of tires, so you get a lot of hand-wringing about the environmental effects. But I think apartheid governments and empire also affect the environment adversely.
Let's cry about a couple burnt tires when we're burning fossil fuels to...
yes, yes.
To run a nation.
When every ad is about, you know, assuming you have a car and all our urbanism and all that. So I just want an update on that and the continuing horror of that. Support the BDS movement and...
I like how he has... It's really hard to see solidarity in movements nowadays, especially where like, the, you know, there's the Women's March, but what are they really marching for? There's... The
is it for abortion
march.
Rights? Is it for higher pay? You know?
I really don't even think they had an agenda when they marched other than...
Just evict Trump.
Yeah, realistically. I mean, I could be wrong there, but I feel like you could really get a large number together if you join groups and actually get some movement made. In
some of the conflict is in how we have... So there's a belief system of thinking that... So these marches are somewhat for cultural change. Raising awareness is about cult. You know, people are just thinking about it. They'll change their behaviors. That's not reality. But there's this... And it's followed on all across the political spectrum, whatever kind of activism you're doing. There's this assumption that politics follows culture. And it comes from left-wing thinkers earlier in the century. And unfortunately, they had some good points to make, for certain. But they were also a little wrong as well, that culture does, in fact, follow from politics, or particularly the economy, the political economy. So, for example, is it simply that there is gay marriage because there was more gay representation and that changed the culture around hating gays? Well, LGBTQ are still not protected legally. They can be evicted, fired, and they have no legal protection as a class. They can just marry now. Or they can marry and be and have certain health care benefits or whatever. But did that follow from all this representation? Did it follow from these more richer gay white men who came out of the closet and thus started donating to these causes and use their money to kind of get the rights that they wanted because they just cared about marrying? They're not going to get evicted. They own their own home. They're not going to lose their job. They own their own business. But those that don't aren't protected at all. But there's also all the agitation that was occurring since the 60s for to not be treated as these social pariahs. And then there's also the question of, is the goal of a marginalized group to just be accepted and become mainstream and be part of our imperial system? Or is it to dismantle it? And there's... those goals are always butting heads in activist circles of, are we here to reform and fight for legislation, or are we here to challenge the very idea of asking other people to intervene on our behalf? So I've actually been using the wrong definition of direct action. Usually I've been using direct action to refer to protests that are a little more confrontational. So it's a very low bar. But direct action, used by the thinkers that I admire, when they use the term, they're referring to acting like the government doesn't exist. Like you just do what needs to be done. And that might include disobeying law or just disregarding it, or the institutions that have systematically failed us. Example, the simplest example, being, because this is where I was getting my ideas, is Occupy. And we didn't have a demand, not because we couldn't come up with one, but that was the strategy, to not ask for a reform and say, no, we're going to build a new society ourselves. We just need the space to do it. So we're going to use this park that's public. And in using our rights to assembly, which are constitutionally guaranteed as they are, but... funny how a lot of moderates and whatevers didn't support our right to assembly eventually. They would cite the safety concerns and say this is about safety. Safety comes before freedom. And send in the cops, and they would turn a blind eye to all of the abuse. And then the way the cops would break fingers, take away people's meds. A lot of our problems were caused by cops. Doing that stuff, and the cops are just simply representatives of the state, and they were scared of what we were doing because we were basically acting like they didn't matter. And that's being irrelevant is what many of us fear. And certainly whether it be Trump supporters or otherwise, they also fear about being irrelevant, because as far as the capitalists are concerned, they are.
I mean, I hate to say it, but a lot of these Trump supporters are irrelevant when they in the causes that they express. For instance, when they talk about their tax cuts, I would say 1% was of America was affected by the tax cuts, not all these people running around with their red hats talking about.
By being in the public eye, they've certainly made themselves relevant as far as liberals and media have concern, and corporate media and mainstream media is concerned. It's all they talk about, right? Trump, Russia, and maybe one segment will be devoted to the ongoing water crisis in Flint. But the teacher strikes happening in more and more states, maybe when they win, it gets mentioned, but not the struggle, not how it happened. How did it work? What did other people, how could I replicate what the teachers are doing? And that needs to be front and center. So that's why, you know, when I talked about it, I mentioned how they used Facebook to organize. And that when you're not just sharing memes and how you're feeling, you can use Facebook as an effective organizing tool. You just have to use it that way. So it's not, for me, it's not worth leaving it over sharing of data, and because that, I mean, why, again, that's allowed by the duopoly.
Well, the data is already out there and it's already been shared, so there's no.
But there's all the new data, whatever. You could cut yourself off and your life is now like your own again or something.
But who's going to tell you, who's going to suggest ads to you, and who's going to tell you who,
I know.
What news you might be interested in.
The advertisers will have to guess, but, and it, like they always have, but they're still kind of doing that. Thank God for Adblock. That's all I have to say. Look, go install Adblock. You know, I mean, a lot of sites will now give you splash pages. You can't access the site until you get rid of Adblock. And so, fine, I whitelist those sites. But then there are all the others that, like, oh, I'm so happy. Because as soon as if I turn it off, because, say, like, my email, Yahoo Mail, it'll put up a splash page no matter what. It's like, hey, your email may not be working right. Yeah, the advertising isn't working right. But when I turn the splash page off, no, the email's fine. It works fine. It's the little bar that's then empty, which then would be filled with little ads for lawnmowers or whatever. If I turn it off, like, I probably will see ads that, like, oh, I bought seeds, so now it's going to give me gardening equipment.
I was about to ask, what are you looking up online or getting emails about that they're offering lawnmowers? But that makes sense. Seeds,
garden equipment, expensive stuff, yeah.
I will not discuss my ads next to my web browser. They are,
it's your business. No, I'm just kidding. It's like your ads are like, yeah. What ads are you getting? That's like, that's the kind of, are you, what kind of, the new astrology, because it's also part guesswork as to, but, and they're both targeted and generalized and abstract or whatever. So the next piece of news, this upcoming this week. Oh, actually, no, what we can talk about is overnight there was the homeless sleep-in where they kind of raised money for HAC, the Homeless Action Committee. So if you know it, you've seen the HAC van, or if someone's passed out, you call HAC. And so they raised money doing a sleep-a-fun. People sleep out in Townsend Park. What a night to do that, huh?
Last night?
Yeah.
It was pretty brutal.
Pretty nippy today, this morning.
Just walking.
And
hope they brought their blankets.
Yeah, their legal homes. So there's not much more to say about that, at least not offhand.
So it was a community-driven...
It's a Homeless Action Committee, which I actually don't know how it was started, but they have resources like their van, and I don't know if they have an office or a place, but you know, you have all these different agencies or offices that are meant to help the homeless or the transient or the people that are passing through. There's Traveler's Aid, there's this and that, and they're all overburdened, in which they're full up, their resources are depleted, time or whatever, and so if you need help, they'll pass you to the next one, and eventually it becomes a circular hot potato. And but when that happens, like, then you've truly slipped through the cracks. You have nothing, you know, between the shelters, Traveler's Aid,
City,
which is kind of about finding you a shelter to stay at.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens when the shelters are full? And the shelters are also a mess socially or otherwise. There's a lot of people who work there, not a majority, but enough, who get their kicks on abusing people who are the lowest rung of society. Not to mention the toxic personalities that are among the homeless, whether they be people who are serially abused their whole lives, and so they're just messes of people, mentally ill, and thus they project a derangedness, which becomes the stereotype people have, whether it's of the homeless or the mentally ill, which leads to hard conversations that Isaac Hopi, guest of the show, is kind of having online about using words like idiot and moron, so generally retarded is now accepted as being a slur towards the mentally handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say so?
I don't mean to step on toes here. I wish we could use it as, because I don't see,
you want to use words as pejoratives.
If I were to say retarded, I wouldn't describe anyone's mental.
But what are you talking about then?
I'm talking about if, let's say, a kid who's bagging my groceries at the supermarket is too occupied on his cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
When realistically he's supposed to be bagging my groceries at the grocery store. I would say that kid, even though he went to high school, got his diploma, decides to smoke weed all day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that kid is retarded, but
not very accurate.
In that sense, like I don't see.
Right, you're not alone in that sensibility. So I'm not. This is another topic to go into much, much deeper, where I actually cite the sources that talk about how using these pejorative words that have the same baggage as other slurs, by the way,
mm-hmm.
They're used by institutions to abuse people, and still presently, actually, there is harm in using moron, idiot,
mm-hmm.
and retarded. It's why the state has switched to using developmentally disabled,
mm-hmm.
and so on. PC words, you know,
yes,
what
yes.
makes it politically correct is that people lobbied, particularly those who deal with mentally ill or the mentally ill themselves, because they are able to do that. They are people with rights, or at least they would like have more rights, because particularly people are labeled something by the state and then the rights are taken away.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's real harms that occur with these words that have the baggage. So the argument, in a superficial way, is that these words do have the same baggage as using kike.
Yeah, others. Yeah. Well, so, I could see the emotional turmoil that comes with labeling and calling someone a certain word. And I see that's why you shouldn't use it. You basically, it's better to take it out of the speech than do.
And it becomes a choice of, like, you know, your actions are having a harm. Are mm-hmm. you going to decide, you know, you have a decision to make. And so this is something, you know, Isaac himself didn't mm-hmm. want to cover this yet. And he has a ear infection right now, so he's not here for that reason. He could have. If he was here, we'd be talking about, what was it?
It's a it's a very touchy subject.
Because he, you know, has been in that position, put into institutions that tortured him,
mm-hmm.
Because he was labeled as insufficiently normal.
Yeah, yeah.
With those words.
I mean, that's the worst part. If with labeling is, like you said, taking one's rights away. That's the biggest fear. Like,
mm-hmm.
it'd be great if you could help someone in a certain way by labeling. Let's say they
close this topic by just saying, like, if you want to use words that are synonyms for ignorant, unaware, or what have you, do so.
Just use those words.
So it reminds you that there are different ways of being kind. If you're kind of raised to think that being kind is just putting up with people, being tolerant, and just kind of hearing people out up to a point. But then there's, like, the kind of what I would call real kindness, which is the actual reducing of harm, generally caring about people, which is particularly hard to do if you've never been taught to do it. It is something that's, like, it's a skill. And sometimes call it a meta skill, because the skill that underlines the ability to do other things. So not much of a segue there, but actually, no, it may come around.
Dan, with that, I'd like to say that I think you are ahead. Kind. I feel like you're a kind person. And it's a hard quality to find.
I like you as well, just
thank
the
you.
Way you are.
I noticed I'm not kind. I noticed.
A little bit of
a little bitter there.
We should all look up to Mr. Rogers. Actually, it's a little pop culture reference here. I've been watching old episodes of a Disney cartoon from the 90s called Recess. And so just to give you some background, it's a grade school, a clique of friends in the fourth grade, and a very diverse clique of friends. So they each have their own speciality and personality. I'm not going to go into the details, but And then there's all the other, and it's very well world. The world is built. Like, everyone has names. Everyone has like nicknames based on what they do.
Everyone's got a job, right?
So there's this. Like the playground is, and the recess is the microcosm of society. Mm-hmm. So the show writers will use it as like a tool to talk about larger social issues, as well as the issues of the time, which have continued, because whether from the 90s or now, neoliberalism is still the ruling idea way of things. So, for example, there'll be episodes about standardized testing and whatever, and government intrusion, trying to get rid of recess. And so there's always an anti-authoritarian strain as well as the moral of the week. And there's a very nuanced moral, or at least a more complicated one, in which the popular girls, known as the Ashleys, there's four of them, they're all named Ashley. Some in the comment thread mentioned that in their school it was Heathers.
Ooh.
And so anyway, they come up with a rating system. They give everyone a rating, a social rating between 1 and 10. And our original clique, you know, our main characters, disregard it. But then they find that everyone else is taking it seriously and starting to group themselves based on their rating. So the Ashleys have created a social hierarchy. To put it bluntly, how are things resolved? So, and it becomes very totalitarian very quickly, where the Ashleys are starting to deduct points from people who stand up for themselves.
So let's just say I was a 5, you were a 6. We couldn't hang out.
Yeah, and I would say, like, you're just a 5.
And you're a 6er.
Yeah.
I wish I was you.
Someone actually asked, like, could we improve our rating? And they go, like, as I was saying, anyone have any real questions?
Oh, shit.
It's so thick, as I would say. So how is it resolved? Our main characters create their own rating system and give everyone a 10. So it's positive equality. Not the kind of the stereotype of communism where everyone's made poor and thus that's how everyone's equal, equally poor. No, everyone's equally rich. And as far as their social standing, everyone is valued the same as a person. Even Randall, the school snitch.
Oh, no.
And so he gets a 1, right? And he's just sitting on his tree on his own, moping. And they give him the 10. And it's like, but why? And the character at the time, who's kind of like the sensitive soul, goes like, because you're good at being you.
Aw.
Yeah.
Isn't that
Daw moment. So I don't know why. It was on my mind because I was on a kick watching these older these episodes with these social messages. And so, a tagline I'll use later, as a transition or whatever, is like Three Left Show, where we learned all our morality from 90s cartoons. Because this is what I grew up with. It wasn't 80s, you know, government sucks and do things on your own, but like Recess had this social cohesion message of teamwork and activism almost, because like some episodes, the solution is to band together and stand up as a group. And most episodes end with this canned crowd cheering. Like the kids, like whatever happens, the kids go, yeah.
Solidarity.
Right. Yes. There's this expression of solidarity, which infected my mind, you know, as well as my family members who were activists themselves. So I grew up around it. So it was normalized for me. It was like, oh, when you think something is wrong, you do some activism. All right, quite a tangent there, but whatever, we're just jabbing.
Catch up on your Recess episodes, folks.
But someone else who does these analysis of pop culture, Jordan Peterson.
Whoa.
See what I did?
Jordan.
Peterson. I don't consider me a hater. I can see him for what he is, which is, he says like he hates postmodernism. So, okay, background. Jordan
First off,
Peterson.
He's Canadian.
Yes.
He's
that alone, right?
A clinical psychologist, culture critic,
right,
professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. But this is Wikipedia.
He was made earn a famous for. So there was a kind of a law passed making it a suable offense. Let's say trans folk have a right to be addressed the pronouns they want.
So if you misgendered someone, if you call right, is that
I forget exactly what it. It was just a guideline. It wasn't like, you know, you got to be jailed or something. But the way Peterson talked about it, it was like it was a mandate.
You're almost taking away my rights.
That he'll be arrested with force if he misgenders someone. And the thing is, he agreed that he wouldn't misgender people. He would agree to people's pronouns, but then he would argue for his right to refuse. So, like, it's this kind of back and forth that makes him kind of right in all things. And so he's kind of turned into kind of a self-help using his philosophy, his postmodernist philosophy, to be a self-help guru, because that's kind of what comes out of postmodernism somewhat. A lot of things do. It's very broad.
So he's almost saying in this instance that by you making me, by you taking away my rights, by not, it's almost like a free speech thing. Like I have the right to say anything I want, and you can't jail me for that, right? Is that pretty much kind of where he's going?
Yeah. The thing was, the guideline wasn't for him, right? It was for the people who would refuse.
Yes.
In the same way that a couple might refuse service to a gay couple.
Yes, yeah.
It's under that rubric. So it is about protecting freedoms of action in our society. And so, but anyway, he's become quite a bit of a self-help guru because he can state these platitudes and then make these grandiose arguments that if you've never encountered any humanities in your life, it seems very, very profound. If you have taken Philosophy 101, it seems banal and confusing. But with our education system the way it is, especially in, let's say, red states, there's no, I don't know what humanities exist. I mean, do they read To Kill a Mockingbird? Do they talk about Plato at all? I mean, at least in Albany High, we cover the allegory of the cave from the Republic, right? Not the whole thing, but at least part of it. And that's enough. That's a start, you know? The basic philosophy concepts, you know? Your friend Eric had the base.
I feel like I missed the base. What's this allegory of the cave? I think I missed that.
Okay.
In high school.
Well, to understand our civilization, as one philosophy professor of mine put it, you should read The Republic by Plato. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bunch of books, meaning it's a bunch of like chapters. Each book is a chapter. And it's Socrates having it's a hypothetical conversation between Socrates and some other notables of Athens, ancient Athens. And they have various philosophical discussions about the nature of justice, society, speciality. They go at length about their kind of utopia, like what would be the best possible government or society? What would maximize justice? And I'm not going to go into all that. I would suggest you yourself. It's a pretty easy read. I got a copy for $2 from a used bookstore in Manhattan under his advisement. Because, like, you know what? Yeah, I should probably read all of it in my spare time. And I read it on the subway, which is what the subway is good for. And so anyway, the allegory of the cave, to sum it up, and you probably already know the metaphor through references that you may not realize.
Pop culture is probably thrown
around. So it's about the nature of truth. What is truth? What is real? And so it's... I'll work backwards. So it starts with, like, say you're tied up in a cave and you are seeing shadows on the wall. And the shadows is the reality you perceive because our senses are not infallible.
That's all you know at the
Things
time.
Things are blurry.
Yep.
Those shadows are cast by a fire. And the fire is kind of like a sub-truth. It's a real light source, but it's also an artificial one made by man. And you're also chained up and just, you can only see the shadows. You are, and that's kind of the metaphor for the person who is, what's it called? With the unexamined life, who isn't thinking about the way they think or how they perceive things. They're just looking, seeing illusions. So then, So the metaphor is you slowly climb out of the cave, and then the cave, there's the sun and the real light source, which is truth. And if you go out too quickly, it blinds you. You're not ready for it, but you gotta climb out slowly and adjust your eyes to the truth, or what truth is. And in Platonic Platonism, as far as like what is real or not, there's the truth is there. Everything has the platonic form, which is like the ideal form. The rock has the ideal rock. The dog has the ideal dog. The human has the ideal human. And we only perceive shadows of it usually. And then there's the platonic version that is abstract, which is ethereal. It's not, we can't actually see it. That's the boilerplate version from my education. I went through most of this through the second philosophy course I took, which is aesthetics, which was actually for architects. So we covered some architecture books too. But it started by talking about Plato, and the professor, this is a fun anecdote. He said, like, he just referenced the allegory of the cave, or it was referenced in material. And someone's asking what the hell it was, like, as you did. And he's like, you've never read The Republic? Like, who here has not read The Republic? Or hasn't? And I kind of like, oh, right, that's the thing, the cave. Like, I did that in 10th grade English, but that's all we did. And between reading Chocolat and Beowulf.
Yeah.
And he just kind of did the double face palm, like, oh, God. Humanities isn't taught in our schools at all.
I was about to say.
Not even a little bit. Not even the allegory of the cave.
We're teaching standardized tests, not...
Right. And it's interesting. Yeah, right. So even if humanities, like, because I look at the tests sometimes via my old job, what... And like, real good literature is there, but it's in the context of we're putting this in front of you to critically analyze it as if it were a scientific document, or in this manner that's mechanized, like that we're going to put all these frames around it, and you're going to describe the frames, like what is this really about. And there's only one true answer. So you don't learn how to interpret things on your own and form your own opinions, even though critical thinking is like the buzzword that's brandished. It actually does the opposite. It makes everyone think the same as far as like, and not actually know how to read critically, which is ironic. At least this is the effect that we're starting to see now. A generation, not entirely, of course, but who are actually getting their humanities education from YouTube.
From clickbait
and YouTubers who pontificate, and like Peterson. So this has been but this is all just the background to talk about Peterson. So I guess we'll go into his 12 Rules, which is his latest book. What I'll do is to introduce. I listened to Trapper Trap House, amazing, funny, raunchy podcast. And they make a lot of references I don't get, actually, but they're self-referential sometimes. Sometimes jokes they came up with last year. But you can kind of get the gist. And so they covered, they've talked about Peterson at length with their own analysis. And it includes what I just said about learning, getting your humanities from YouTube. Like, no one's ever read any philosophy. Not no one, but his fans. And their first interaction with philosophy has been Peterson, because he dedicated himself to putting almost all of his lectures and content on YouTube and delivering it in this engaging way, putting on silly hats, I think, you know, and talking about pop culture and obsessing over Disney movies.
So almost like the Frozen of neoliberalism, or the carry on. I apologize.
He hates Frozen. Yeah. Whoa. You're tired, and he hates Frozen because it's one of his things to say. Is that art is only valid if it's based on the old archetypes, the hero's journey kind of stuff.
Let it go, Peterson.
And if it isn't, if it deviates or questions it, or just plays like Frozen did, like, oh, it's not following the archetype of women needing a man. It's not based on the truth anymore, right? The truth of the old archetypes
and
the myths. But modern ideologies, and thus apparently it's not real art.
God forbid
it has a message. You know,
the leading female doesn't need a prince to come and save her. That's
I'm waiting for the movie where the princess then like It's been done in some things like Wreck-It Ralph, actually. But the princess decides that they're going to abolish the monarchy because it's too much trouble.
Wow. I don't need serfs to...
But through like conflict, though, not just on a whim, which was the case in Wreck-It Ralph.
Just woke up on the right side
of
the bed.
It just happened at the end. It was actually a little cringy to me. But only after kind of listening to Nia Sarkeesian describe her ideal kind of story, female empowerment story of a game called like The Last Princess. And so I encourage you to check that out because I bow before her shrine. Though actually, I've listened to a few episodes of her podcast via Feminist Frequency, and I'm not really quite enjoying it. I didn't enjoy it, but again, that's just because of what she concentrates on, and she's more just going to what do you call it the developers and advising them as a consultant, and not say organizing the workers there, and then thus they would have more solidarity with women by the mere fact, well, not the fact, but in organizing, you find you have more solidarity with your fellow compatriots, and thus you could see that in the world more.
Mm-hmm.
More solidarity instead of, I'm just working for my paycheck and screw all these women who want respect. To get back, so we're going to cover Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules. This is his new book, bestseller.
Do you think it has anything to do with the 12 Commandments?
Yes.
Like cultish,
those 15, actually.
Oh, and he dropped one. And yeah. Dropped one. Oh, shucks. Sorry, God. Mel Brooks.
Love it. Okay.
That's a mic reference.
So
guys.
First, I'm working off of what Chapo, like they talked for an hour. I'm going to condense it down to 10 minutes. So his first rule is stand up straight, which is just about projecting your place in society, be confident in yourself kind of thing. He kind of uses and it's good to have a positive self-image. So that's really the advice, have a positive self-image. But then he puts it in the context of talking about all these animal social hierarchies, which most of which only exist when we put animals in captivity.
You mean like PETA, or what do you mean by animal social? Oh, I see what you're saying.
So it talks about pecking orders and lobsters competing for resources. It uses lobsters. Lobsters stand up straight.
Oh.
I'm not going to... Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I want to stay away from it.
That's in far left field. Holy cow.
Yeah. He's a weird
Literally,
guy.
Holy cow.
He's a weird guy, okay? Wow. But I don't want to talk about his weirdness. Yes. I really just kind of want to talk about...
Back to the commandments.
His social Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
In... say like just like all the internet culture with the alt-right with alphas versus betas thing, which it's bad science. Like the scientist who observed wolves, okay, and this is, you can go to Adam Ruins Everything. He has a little short video on this. It's a brilliant little animation. He observed wolves. He thought there was an alpha beta kind of hierarchy. Then a few years, you know, after publishing his book, gets popular, goes back, observes more wolves, because he's a scientist, but observes new things and changes his thinking, his theories. He was mistaken. It wasn't just a whole group of wolves. He was watching a parent-child dynamic. So the alphas were in charge as far as parents in charge of their young. And so it's like, oh, it's totally not. It's totally social. It's not a hierarchy. It's just this parent-child relationship, the pack is just one big family unit. So, but he would try to draw attention that, but it had already stuck, because in our competitive capitalist economy and society, this idea of it just fed into social Darwinism, which hasn't gone away at all, even though its most blatant. What it leads to, if you use a slippery slope, it does lead to ethnic cleansing, genocide, and eugenics.
I mean, that's the biggest fear about labeling a certain group
eugenics.
Is eugenics,
right?
Let's
and it hasn't gone away.
Yeah,
it's not the right wingers were talking about like it's all in the past. while they're promoting something from the past.
It's all in the past, but please put your birth country on the census and tell. It's just
that's relevant news. It's funny how some of these alt-writers, you know, consider themselves socially liberal, and then they're just completely isolationist. This came up in a debate between two YouTubers, and everyone gets their news on YouTube, at least our age does, because mass media is just as it is. So moving on.
They sold out. Dang.
Rule two, treat yourself like someone that you would be seeking to help, which is just kind of a be kind. Particularly, it's about self-care.
It's the flip around of the treat yourself as you would want to be treated. Mm-hmm. It's almost
treat yourself as someone you would want to help. So it's a version of self-care, which is something that, again, that's like a meta skill to be able to put yourself first and not worry about everyone else and what everyone's thinking, that kind of thing. But also because some people do get so engrossed that they don't care about themselves enough, and they start self-hating, or they don't. It's like meditate or mm-hmm. whatever. So again, rule three: make friends, and define friends as people who care about you. So these are very simple truism rules, but through bad socialization or whatever or upbringing, these are things that a lot of people don't seem to know. Like if a friend is someone who does favors for you, but out of obligation. That like some a lot might see friendship like that, and not people who care, like don't sincerely care about each other. Four is compare yourself internally. Compare yourself. It's a little like kind of a self-progression thing. Compare yourself to you how you were yesterday, not to others today. Which is, you know, kind of good advice as far as the whole don't compare yourself to others too much. There's some add-ons you could put on there.
No, yeah, but that makes sense.
The way he argues for these, this good life advice, is for this hyper-individualism, which is the main criticism. That's like, you have to... Oh, yeah. So he frames it as... Philosophically, the only thing you know for real is yourself. Everything else is chaos that you have to fight. And maybe he'll frame it like it's you come to a synthesis, a compromise. But he also frames it as fighting it. And then he also frames the self and order as masculine and chaos as feminine, which is where the gender politics thing comes in.
Whoa.
Then
I feel like you could have used different references.
And it makes everyone else like almost like a sort of pseudo enemy, that you can't know them. You can't understand them. You can't have solidarity. It makes solidarity impossible. And that's the main point that Chapo had. There is a society. You know, he's coming from the Thatcherian, you know, there is no society. It's just individuals competing like lobsters, apparently, even though I'm sure lobsters have some social dynamics too, just as chickens and whatever, when they're not penned or caged and put in boxes or whatever,
I mean, what's,
or water tanks at our grocery store.
Yeah, what's a lobster's day-to-day life besides running away from these big nets? And
it goes to a big social experiment on mice that I encountered via another philosophy class, actually, where I actually read postmodern authors. So I have experience reading how incomprehensible and it is, and see that in Peterson as well. And his books are very long.
I just love how we're studying animals put into an environment that's like a box, and we're like, let's see how these.
Yeah, that was the case with the mice. So like, there was two environments. One was very open, not a lot of mice, plenty of resources, and it was like mice utopia. All the mice got along. It was a great social system that they had.
Yeah, there's drugs in the water. We love this.
Whatever. There was enough water. Mice could get to it. And then there was like this more claustrophobic environment. A lot of mice, less resources. And of course, it devolves into...
the mice games?
Yeah, whatever. It became a wreck. All the mice were chewing each other's tails. There were these social hierarchies that then developed with these alpha, you know, alpha mice. But again, this only happened in these environments of scarcity. If there is abundance and people and all of the entities, the animals, whether they be human or otherwise, have access, then things are not so negative, and this human nature thing that we project about us being imperfect and just naturally greedy. Yes, in our competitive society, we're naturally greedy. But if there is abundance, then people are just generally nicer and better. And the virtues can just either come out naturally, or they can be then reinforced. Virtuous behavior, as it were. Next, don't let... Oh, yeah, so this is a weird one. Don't let your kids do anything that makes you dislike them. So they didn't go that deep into what he was actually talking about, but like it was just discipline and punishment. Mm-hmm. And it also seems kind of capricious. That's like, don't let your kids do anything you would do. Or like what would your kids do to make you not like them? And he's mostly talking about kids who are just mean. So, and this goes into a deeper conversation about how do you discipline kids. And I've had conversations with parent friends of mine, and it's the main thing to focus on is it's not a punishment is just a negative consequence, but you can have consequences that aren't violence, mm-hmm. Or shouting, right? Usually like when it comes to an argument against spanking, like does your kid understand the reason why you're spanking them? No, then don't spank them. Can they then use reason? Because it means that they can use reason, which is usually the age of 7. So what do you do before 7? You create consequences that aren't violent. So as one parent friend of mine put it, well, he loves his Legos. I put away the Legos out of sight. He can't play with Legos. That's if he leaves the Legos out and doesn't put them away and I step on one. The consequence is he doesn't get the Legos. You take away something they like, right? Not something they need, but something they like.
So don't take the milk away, but the Legos. That makes sense.
Or dinner, yeah. Or whatever. But like dessert. I mean, usually it's dessert. You don't get dessert. And that's, it's, you know, it's, they're not going to starve. It's not inherently violent. It's taking away something they like. And so it's a consequence. And I didn't like it, especially when I was a teenager, because it meant that, it was funny, never mind, I'm not going to go personal. But
Dan didn't get his ice cream.
Well, yeah. it was video games, actually.
Oh.
But high school just wasn't engaging me. I just didn't care enough. And instead of making arguments why I should care, or my parents say stepping up and making, like, say going to the PTA meetings again, and it's like, why are the classes so boring? Dan finds the homework boring, and he doesn't want to do it. But I mean, it was also just kind of a little arrogance. Like, I didn't need to do the homework because I knew the material already.
Oh, yeah.
So it's I didn't see a reason to do it.
Yeah.
There was that, too. So,
I mean, that's
maybe I'm just
schools,
making excuses.
Yeah.
You know, I was a teenager, and that's what my brain's on.
You weren't engaged, man. It makes sense. It's.
But yeah, it's. I mean, it apply it. So, moving on.
But
yeah,
basically,
we're quickly running out of time.
In Law 5, it's.
Yeah.
It's be the cool dad, I would say.
Sure.
Cool.
6, put your own house in order before criticizing the world. So, again, very non-systematic approach. So it's like, put your own house in order. Oh, yeah, sorry. He puts it in your house in perfect order. But then he goes on and on about how imperfect humans are. So how can you be? You'll never be perfect. You can always move the goalposts. And then you can never criticize the world around you. It's always just yourself and an internal struggle.
He's almost like saying you got a lot to work on before you can deal with this world.
Even though some of your problems are solved by dealing with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of my problems even now, social nature. I am, you know, I still a bit of an introvert. I don't know if it's something to fix. It's not something I feel ashamed about. It's just a different way of my brain working. But to still be comfortable in social situations, to be able to mingle and not feel like awkward every single time I just like stand around a click and like, oh, hi. or, you know, now it's just with if I'm selling something or if I need to pitch, and it's like there's a pressure to, like, you got to get these people on your side now. It's like, well, that's, I know that's not really possible. Which is what pitchmen, whatever. Let's see. Only got a minute left here in the before, and I do want to move on. Purpose. What is? Oh yeah. So pursue things that are meaningful and not expedient. Great advice. Tell the truth and don't lie. Great advice. 9. Assume others can be learned from. And the more criticism of this is that Peterson does not follow some of these rules. Be precise in your speech. Peterson is not precise. He goes on and on and on for hours. 11. Don't bother kids when they skateboard. This is apparently just ranting about postmodernism.
And going to number 12.
Weird.
I feel like he just ran out of rules.
And then, no, that's 11. 12 is then pet a cat when you see one in the street, which is just stop and smell the roses, enjoy life. Don't, you know, it's just... And another point to finish up with that Chapo kind of made, and it's not a – this was a theory. This is just like, here are some possibilities. The fans that he really has are the upper middle class kids that have no boundaries. No one's ever told them to clean their room. Or if they did, they didn't take it seriously because there was no real consequence of not cleaning their room. And so they've gone through their life, they're in college now, whatever, and they still haven't cleaned their room, or they still don't know how even to organize their life. And now you have a guy on YouTube, because let's say they grew up, and the only thing that they would take seriously is things on YouTube, things that their friends are doing, or the media that actually made sense and wasn't just propaganda, just or at least honest in what kind of propaganda it was, as we are. And so when someone online tells them to clean their room, they might actually take it seriously. That's just one idea. Not what to think, how to think, and kind of the baseline ideas of where being, you know, left comes from. Like, solidarity is caring about others as yourself, and caring about yourself at the same time. And with that, I'm going to... So the remaining two stories we have, two sections, will be continuing that thread in various ways. So the next one is kind of morality. And this is actually an article now. Current Affairs, from Current Affairs, a magazine of politics and culture, which leans left, and so that's why I kind of like it. It's from February 12th of this year, so it's, I guess I saved it a bit ago. Or it was shared with me via some other page. Maybe because I used a Current Affairs article in another episode, maybe it's been sending me more. So the title is, Does Caring About Other People Mean You Have to Be a Joyless Aesthetic? It's written by Nathan Robinson. Subtitle, Moral Codes That Require Bare Subsistence Are Unworkable and Will Create a Worse World. So first, on the far left, we have a Truist meme line called, there is no ethical consumption in capitalism. You know, there's all of these advertising lines about, like, buy this product, it's more ethical. This one uses less plastic.
Toilet paper without a roll.
Right. But at the end of the day, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. So it's just kind of a mantra. And it doesn't negate the need to make better purchasing or you know, to think about your consumption, but it's also more about thinking of it in the larger context that no matter what, you're still using toilet paper, you're still using paper, you're still using trees and wood pulp. So
and assuming you're still using oil, you're still, there's no getting around,
you're still driving a car, is still, yeah, it's my mantra of a car is still a car.
Yeah,
if it's electric, even if it runs on vegetable oil, it's still a car that requires all this infrastructure. You know, we can, install charging stations for electric cars and move that way. And it's like, it's still a car. It still means that ads for the ones in Del Mar in the suburbs, like, it's definitely like you need a car to do anything. And when it's suggested otherwise, I really do scoff. I'm like, no, Del Mar is not bikeable to me because it means, like, I have to bike, then I have to catch the 18. It's like, it will take me an hour to get to Lark Street. not a full hour, but like, I don't know, 40 minutes.
Between setting up, getting there.
Even if I just bike, I mean, it would be just as fast if I just biked the whole way,
yeah.
Which is what I guess some people do. Okay, the question, so it kind of starts with the critique of charity, or at least talking about charity, the using of money, that any money spent not on charity is wasteful spending. And this kind of false dichotomy of what is wasteful spending, you know, like, is any luxury wasteful spending when it's not spent on the poor? This question poses a serious challenge to anyone who believes in analyzing people's spending choices from a moral perspective. Of course, many on the left don't believe in that kind of analysis. You could adopt the Oscar Wilde or Slavoj Žižek view that charity actually reinforces oppression because it mitigates the harms of a system and prevents people from understanding the systematic problems. I agree with this, and I'd add on that charity is a hierarchical relationship between a giver and those receiving aid. And people who receive aid don't really have much control over how they get aid. Whether it be in the food welfare programs that they don't control and have a say over how it's distributed, or development money through the city grants. There's all these hoops. There's all these conditions, and it limits people's potential and the mindscape that people can imagine what they could do. But he kind of looks at it kind of negatively. I'm comfortable with any theory that concludes that you should actually make people's lives worse on purpose. Which is, I don't agree with, like, kind of that's not what they're saying, but I can kind of go with that as well. But even if you don't say that, you could say that while charity is good, it's not morally mandatory, and we shouldn't analyze consumption choices through a moral lens because they're relatively unimportant. What matters is the justice or injustice of the system of wealth distribution, not what people do once that wealth has been distributed as unequally as it has been, especially since the 08 crash. If I am trying to decide whether to spend my millions either buying eyeglasses for nearsighted children or purchasing enormous barrels of feathers to jump in, what happens to the children depends on my decision. So this is him about taking a consequentialist that his choice, a consumptive choice, still has effects, even if it's just one individual.
Almost by helping them, you're hurting them. And basically in the article, he's saying by helping the poor, you're actually hurting them in the long run, and you're not... By not letting them hit rock bottom.
It's more, that's like the worst interpretation of like what far leftists say,
yes,
in this terms. But what I would say, what we're really saying, okay, or the right interpretation is you're helping them in the short term.
Yeah.
But not in the long term. Mm-hmm. That if we want to solve poverty as a problem, we have to solve capitalism, because poverty is a byproduct.
Yeah.
It's a byproduct. It's the same way that pollution is a byproduct of industry. Poverty is a byproduct of business as usual. And that's something that's hard to accept on face value, but it's something to come to grips with.
I mean, it's huge. How else are you supposed to, you know, how else do you get ahead in a capitalistic society unless you can work to your fullest capability? But what happens if you can't work to your fullest capability and are then put behind? Like, there's no reward if you don't put the risk in, but then why can't we just share the reward?
So I'm going to go through just my outline here instead of trying to read the article.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it to anyone who's really interested to read it themselves. Link will be via Facebook page. So he talks about how moral code should be realistic, and that either saving all your money to give to charity is unrealistic. It's, you know, it's not something people are going to be able to just say, well, we'll do it. You know, how do you resolve, well, what about your spending? Kind of a back and forth. Been tempted with this. Maybe we shouldn't go to space for a while. Something like that. So he solves this by, in his own mind, defining terms of needs versus waste. We all need to have some amount of fulfillment or enrichment in our lives. He uses the example of an umbrella, a nice umbrella that is something of a luxury, and having a nice umbrella. You don't need an umbrella, really. You could have a hood coat or something, but a nice umbrella is a luxury. It would be waste to have 200 of such umbrellas. Kind of that, and this leads into a kind of more Marxist terms of, but super important to understand, use value versus exchange value. So that's the difference. So use value is the value that we of things we need, and exchange is then something's value in relation to everything else. For example, using a, I think it's a, either a PBS show or just on YouTube, it's called Is It Worth It? And this was used by another YouTuber to actually talk about capitalism, and so I'm going to use it too. It's so look up ContraPoints for that analysis, but I'm just going to repeat it because it is really good, and I've been looking for ways to just talk about this. So these guys, like, say they get a $5,000 pizza that's made of gold and whatever, and I've seen videos of it about it before, and then they get like a regular New York City pizza for $5. And which is the better pizza? What is the better value? What is it? What is it worth it? Now, of course.
Well, is it the best pizza in New York, though? Does it have the sign up front?
It's a regular pizza.
Okay.
But all pizza is a good pizza.
Yes.
But the gold one is terrible. So its exchange value is super high, but it's not worth it. Yeah. It's waste. But the regular pizza, which has a use value for its quality and being edible pizza, is such. And that's the that's what makes rent so high, that the exchange value of certain properties can be $500,000 when its use value is significantly less, like the actual value of the materials and what have you, especially when all that value is from what other people are doing, infrastructure created by the state, what have you. Next, he then talks about, he addresses luxury leftism. We talked about this before somewhat misleadingly as luxury leftism, the idea that nothing is too good for the working class and that we should be trying to make sure everyone gets some comforts and pampering rather than encouraging everyone or anyone to have a life of deprivation and aestheticism, which is the philosophy of living as simply as possible to the point of wearing rags and such, very Christ-like. Giving up all your possessions.
Joining a cult.
Let's say it's misleading, though, because it suggests that there's no upper limit to what's permissible, that being a champagne socialist is fine even if the champagne in question is absurdly costly. I don't think that's true. The point is that you should get to have indulgences, not that you should get everything. There is an upper limit to the number of cravats I think I should own before it becomes obscene. So this is the framework he uses and then kind of goes through. So what is the amount for a fulfilled, joyful life without being wasteful? It sounds like it's rationalizing access, but actually it's strengthening the force of the indictment against the super wealthy. If we believe that what is justified is, quote, what is necessary for a good, fulfilled, and joyful life, and no more, then really any retention of wealth over a certain amount cannot be defined. There is a kind of maximum moral income. Maybe peg it at $30,000, $50,000, or $100,000. We know through studies that it's actually between 70 and 80.
Yeah, I thought it was 70, yep.
Yep. So,
and I would think depending on the area you're living in.
And so he's going through an argument. I've already come through my own head, but I'm just relating it in this way, which is... So it's written down and it's well written. So adopting a maximum moral income conception is useful because once you have it, the protests of the rich seem that more feeble. If we believe that anything non-essential is wasteful and immoral, then the nice umbrella I buy on my 30 grand a year salary is on the same category as a $90 million spaceship launch. And since my umbrella seems intuitively fine to most people, the force of the critique of waste at the upper end is blunted. Whereas, if we define a line, a bit a debated one, and agree that whatever falls below it is fine and whatever falls above it isn't, we aren't left with a philosophy that is practically unworkable. In fact, it then becomes much more difficult to defend the things in the waste category because we've limited it to the worst cases. Can anyone defend having 10 cars as something without which life would be significantly worse. I am sure there are plenty of utilitarians. That only addresses utilitarians, which I have some patches with, who are still deeply uncomfortable with this because they still view every dollar spent on a bag of pistachios as a dollar not spent on reducing malaria. And they would say, I've become my Confederate soldier, someone who is doing the indefensible morally, but because of the social circumstance and is backed into a corner and isn't allowed to be, to make the moral choice of leaving the army or, my buddies that I'm fighting with are good people. We're being honorable. So, we must be fighting for something worth it. And that mentality has, exists today.
Yeah, I would think,
spades.
That'd be the only way.
This is not to say such morality. So, and it also makes it easier to think about, like, if we had a maximum income. Now, technically, high tax rates, like 90% tax rates on those that make more than, say, $1 million, which is what we had in the 50s, was kind of an effective maximum income. And that's kind of how you, at least with taxation and the welfare state, reduce inequality. But it's still there, and it's kind of what allowed the millionaires to buy government again.
I mean, that's the scariest thing. How could you see, like, money buys politics, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It's political power.
And how could, so one person, let's say Jeff Bezos, is more powerful, not in this state, but more powerful than a country. Like one man could be more powerful than.
So we reached the end of the segment, unfortunately. No. So I'll just conclude with, like, it goes that the stance of the maximum income and anything above that, this is a good way of, it leads to rather socialist or left-wing positions, naturally, I think. But it's both challenging how people think about their spending and reasonable in that it is saying it's okay to go to the movies once in a while and spend money on local business. It's still capitalism, and it's truly never completely ethical. Because there's always going to be exploitation, but we can fight that and recognize it and realize we can do something about it and not feel helpless and that we have to just give into charity and as many do.
It's the three lefts. We won the sign war of 2017.
The show for Commons Economy, and we're talking about how do we become more, what kind of thinking, what kind of ideas do we need to consider to have more solidarity with others and not get pigeonholed into what is usually stereotypically left and right, where you're either completely for individual rights and the individual is everything and there's no society, or it's just society, it's all social forces, individuals don't matter. That stereotype of your social justice warrior or what have you, which I also identify with. It's a unfair stereotype, just as many things are people projecting, and I'll go into that when I talk about the Green Party. So I'll just tease that. So we'll talk about the Green Party at length, my experience and various points as we talk about the gubernatorial race. But we'll finish up this week's show with kind of what is the philosophy of myself? Is there a middle ground between community and individuals? Now, intuitively, it seems like there is, but it's hard to articulate. It's hard to figure out based on what's around us in our daily lives, what does that look like? And I've put a lot of effort into kind of asking and trying to answer those questions to the best of my ability. And it really helps in imagining such new ways of doing things and institutions and organization that isn't top down. It's one thing to say we need things to be less top down. And it's like, how do we do it? How does it work? How does it not just become rabble, 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 as South Park would put it? Because whenever, like, when there isn't some authority guiding things, it turns into rabble, rabble, rabble. So this is from Solo Punk Anarchist, which is a great little aggregator of little social anarchist tidbits. And so it has a meme that I haven't been able to blow up too much But so it's just a little chart. I referenced it a week or so ago, but I'm not going to dive into it and go line by line because I think it's important. Because so basically it has three columns. It has a individualism, like these are the points of the main positions of individualism, especially when it's taken too far. Collectivism, which is then, you know, what is bad. This is inherently what's bad about communism or socialism, and this is the projection I have of why this is bad, and I prefer individualism over collectivism any day based on how I live my life, right? Because especially in America, we've been living like individuals. As individuals, it's been hammered into us. And so when someone mentions some collectivist position, it's alien and threatening. I can personally attest to that. It took me some grips. And I could only really, I wouldn't identify as a socialist or a left wing, a far left wing. And I wasn't comfortable with these labels until I got to this middle ground, which one thinker, Alan Carter, calls interrelationism. So the middle ground is, so the main sense is, so like the column A, or row A, the individual is considered to possess supreme and intrinsic value. In collectivism, it is the collective that possesses supreme intrinsic value, right? So a middle ground would be that individuals are considered to possess value in their relations with other people. Row B, the individual is autonomous, uninfluenced by others, and is self-directed, right? The Jordan Peterson, clean your own room before you can clean the world. Mm-hmm. And in within collectivism, it's an individual is subject to the totality of social forces, the social constructs of gender and race and the things that SJWs and other leftists talk about at length, and they seem a little divorced from individual, like our experiences as individuals when they talk like that. But if we talk about how individuals are, we are self-directed, but we are heavily influenced, we are influenced by others, which is undeniable. You think it's self-evident, but then the solutions aren't framed as that. They're not framed as we need to talk about how we relate to each other, which is technically what the social justice warriors are doing, asking to think about how we relate to each other because of these forces. And it's directed to individuals.
So rather than section each other off and make small little groups, find
an identity politics.
Find a common factor to, like, how can we relate?
Yeah.
And how can we?
Because you can still have identity politics and solidarity. It's mm-hmm. that this is the middle ground I'm talking about. To have the starting point that we're individuals and we affect each other, regardless of what identities we hold.
Almost like the. And I don't know how they all came together. I would have just assumed unified goal of the LGBTQ community.
Mm.
Whereas realistically, they're different.
There are many goals.
There's many goals, but they all come together, and
it's why like the alphabet, the acronym has grown as new groups have come forward saying like we're marginalized.
Too. I didn't even think Yeah, how many letters is it?
And you have to, and you know, you have to fight almost to be included within the marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
So, big example for me is asexuality. People without a sexuality, people who don't have sexual attraction by nature, right? They're born that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just as some are attracted in that. But because asexuality isn't explicitly like oppressed, like it isn't mentioned. There's no laws against not being sexual, mm-hmm. right? If anything, you're held up as a paragon of virtue. But that's actually wrong. No, you're also shamed for being a virgin and not having had sex yet or not wanting to have sex. You're shamed by family members who want grandchildren. You're shamed, you know, it's like there's all these pressures to have sex, but just in a controlled fashion if there's a conservatism there. And
so there's no law on the books that says you have to get married, but Mm-hmm. It's in a social aspect, you are pressured into.
It's incentivized.
Yeah.
That's what the whole marriage equality thing was about, because there are all these incentives for being married.
Mm-hmm.
And gay couples should want those incentives too,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating. That's why I'm with the position of just marriage should not be a state institution. There should be no laws about it whatsoever.
Free love.
I'm a relationship anarchist here. Because it runs the other way, where then you have all this kind of rhetoric about you're not a complete person without your sexuality, or rather being sexualized and being a sexual person, which is totally important, you know, to be sex positive. But then if you aren't interested in that, or not interested in romance because you've never had a crush before, you weren't capable of it. That's the way I feel. And when I mention, like, oh, I identify as aromantic, not quite fully asexual, and I'm always getting a similar kind of pushback that if I said I was gay, are you sure? You just haven't tried it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, have you tried having sex with a man and you say you're heterosexual? How do you know? And it's like, well, I'm not interested. Well, exactly. You're telling me I should be interested in something.
Yeah, almost like try the broccoli, Dan. You'll like the broccoli. Just try it.
Maybe you just need it in cheese sauce.
Yeah, ranch. You know? Ranch is good.
And so on. Good. This is a funny little comic.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll share it another time. But it's basically like what asexuality feels like. And it's giving, it's like someone picking your nose.
Mm-hmm.
And then like it's really good for them. But it's like, ow.
Yeah, you're just picking my nose. There's no.
So, that's probably.
What are you doing in my nose, dude?
Yeah. Well, it could be consensual, but like you're giving it a shot.
Yeah.
But it's not pleasure. Yeah, it's not pleasure. So, okay. Oh yeah. So we'll go down the list. May need to cut that. I don't know. I'll ask Rose. Rose is in the other room. So we'll go down. So you'll see a pattern with this meme here. The individual ought to be left in a private sphere, so there's individualism, sphere of thought and or action, immune from the incursion of others or the wider public. So this is like negative freedom, the freedom to be left alone. In a collectivism, the individual ought to think and act solely with the collective in mind. The thoughts and actions of the collective are the ultimate value. So very, you know, thinking of Borg or something like that, where the individual doesn't, it still exists, right? But it's subsumed or it's not. But let's have a common ground. The individual ought to think and act not only of themselves, but with regard to respecting the needs of others, right? So it keeps going, like morality, you know. Oh, there's the only political authority is with an individual. But if we to apply interrelationism, if there is a political authority, only related individuals could be the source of it. So this is the basis to me of direct democracy. There's no just, the collective isn't the political entity, the individual isn't. It's people's interactions. It's how we relate to each other, that power is actually like, how our actions affect others is where we should be regulated by the people we interact with. We shouldn't be regulated by people far away or another town. If it's a local issue, it can only be regulated by the locality. And there shouldn't be a top-down law that applies to everything, because otherwise what you're getting is there are movements that want to accomplish things, but the law doesn't allow them to. And if they do try to accomplish it, then the law will come down and there will be force. This is kind of like, there will be right-wingers that actually make this argument, and it kind of drives me up the wall. As far as what, then they're just contradictory, but they certainly articulate it properly in the whole, eventually, most government interaction is backed by force, bureaucracy in particular. And there should be other ways of dealing with our problems than calling the cops so people don't get shot, as what happened in Brooklyn recently. And in another episode, I'll cover what to do instead of calling the police. So we'll have a whole another episode on restorative justice and the alternatives.
We're just tipping our toes in it right now.
Right. But that policing of, right, it should be how we interact with each other instead of top down. Another example. The individual is responsible only for their own destiny. Or the collective is responsible for its own destiny and the destiny of its members. To go between, the individuals are responsible for their own destinies and those of others. So it's the very simple new truism that I hear when media that I like is the I'm responsible for myself and others. That there is two types of responsibility, the individual and the collective, that both can, they actually do need each other. You can't be personally responsible without being responsible to others. And you can't be responsible to others without being self-accountable and having your own discipline, right? And when you're missing one or the other, you get these oddities of the Peterson and the demagogues. You get demagogues in these gaps of where something is lacking. Just like the certain charts where like sins are just kind of the too much of a good thing or too little of a good thing. And because virtues can also be expanded to become bad things. So when you're lawful, the virtuousness of being lawful, it can become being overly bureaucratic and trying to regulate everything, the interactions of everyone. And it's like everything is permitted or nothing is permitted. And call out culture on, and you know, left-wing Tumblr, you know, the alt-left or whatever, the Tumblr feminism. It's bureaucracy being applied to our social interactions where we all have to self-regulate ourselves and not permit anything or as little as possible. And that's just internalizing and repeating what our systems do. So it's got to break out, you know, how do we do it? And I hope this episode has given you some ideas as to where to start. This is just more of a, this show is meant to be a starting point. And then we'll have other episodes that then explore beyond the starting point. Because it does need to be explained, right? What solidarity is, caring about others like yourself to actually apply the golden rule that exists as a, in every human culture. Any thoughts?
No, it makes sense. I think this show is where you'd have to explain those things. You're not going to find them on YouTube channels that throttle certain views over others. You're not going to find them in mainstream media. I mean,
AM radio.
Yeah,
which is all right wing.
It's a great platform to try to push.
Not on Channel 6, which has just been bought by Sinclair Media. They just created their own little hive mind there, at least when it's edited together. So we're on the show with music. Keep going.
So this has been the Three Lefts, though. We are 8 years late to the podcasting wave, but we're still getting wet. So that's great. We also
our feet wet.
Our feet, all the way up to our ankles. And we're also going to send all those haters to Gulag.
So closing is talking about our Facebook feed that we post our things there. Three Left Show on Facebook and Patreon now. So we're going to devote, I'm going to devote like 15 hours a week to this between editing, recording here, and generally making the show better. Maybe even doing real journalism eventually, where I actually call people up and ask them for feedback and whatever. Investigate something, an issue that's local. This isn't a journalistic show. It's more of the analysis and the philosophy, right? The thinking behind. Bye-bye.
Stay radical.
I can't sleep, no, not like I used to. I can't breathe. I can't help you out. I've been pushing me.
too.